Welcome to History of Anarchist Thought Lecture 2. For those of you here, I want to give you some good news. You've gotten past the hardest part of the course, which was lecture number one. Remember lecture number one? I was talking a lot about Hegel's philosophy, which is not the easiest topic in the world to talk about. Remember, on the absolute mind coming to consciousness of itself. Well, for the rest of the course, we can assume the absolute mind has already become conscious of itself and don't have to worry about the absolute mind anymore. Let the absolute mind take care of itself, and we can go on to more mundane matters. Now, remember, in the course, what we're going to do, rather than give a history of anarchist thought, trying to give all the major figures from antiquity to the present, I just selected a few people to concentrate on. Now, you might wonder why I picked Proudhon and Bakunin. They're not exactly names you would get a lot in if you're reading libertarian anarchist writing. So if you go to the Mises site, you don't see reprints from either Proudhon or Bakunin. And the reason for this is I think sometimes, I did this deliberately, because I think sometimes if we're libertarian, we tend to get caught up in a rather closed world of writers, but that's really certain writers, and we don't sometimes realize the broader context of ideas in which some of these people were writing, say, in mainstream intellectual history, say, Benjamin Tucker wouldn't be such a big name like Samuel Spooner, but in libertarians, Spooner is very important. I think he was certainly important, but back in the ancient times, I got my start as a European historian, and so I'm interested in this broader European context for the anarchist movement, so that was why I decided to give this lecture on Proudhon and Bakunin. Now, we want to ask, well, why should we study these particular people? And as I've suggested, both of them, Proudhon and Bakunin, were among the most influential of all anarchist writers. If you went to a conventional course in history of Europe in the 19th century or history of modern political thought, and the course touched on the anarchist movement, Proudhon and Bakunin are two names you would certainly encounter. Both of them are usually classified as left-wing anarchists. They were both very hostile to the capitalist economic system, and they both believe in a kind of syndicalism, which syndicalism is a system where organized groups of workers run the economy. It isn't one where there's a price system. You just have the same as a free market. You just imagine workers running the firms instead of having capitalists. Somehow, it's not clear how the various groups of workers decide on who will get what, but they generally, the system doesn't involve using price. Of course, Mises is very boring. That wouldn't work. That was what they believed in. But although they're usually classified as left-wing anarchists, they were influential among others also. As we'll see later in the course when we talk about Benjamin Tucker, the great American individualist anarchist, Proudhon influenced him. In fact, Tucker was a translator of one of Proudhon's major works on the history of the European Revolution. And we'll also see, when we talk about Lysander Spooner, one of the things Spooner is most famous for is an attack on the notion of government by consent. You know, we say today, well, why should we obey the U.S. government? Why does the U.S. government have legitimacy? And people, a lot of people say, well, people in our systems opposed to dictatorships, people have consented to the government. And as we'll see today, Proudhon had very similar ideas. I don't know that Spooner mentions him, but he was probably familiar with his books because they had been translated into English. But my suspicion would be that he was aware of it. I don't recall if he cited him. Spooner seems to have been mainly influenced, developed his ideas pretty much on his own. He was a lawyer and he was very much interested in applying the common law principles of contract to the notion of consent. We'll get to him in one of the later lectures. Now, we're going to talk first about Proudhon, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon. Proudhon was born in Besançon, which is in eastern France. It's near the Swiss border. He was born there in 1809, he died in 1865. And he was from a very poor family. He wasn't somebody who just went off and went to university and became an academic. He was trained as a printer and also a copy editor. He was largely self-educated. He taught himself Latin. In fact, when he was he became so good at correcting mistakes in Latin, he attracted a lot of people's interest, and people sponsored him. He studied for a while in an academy, and people were very interested in him because of his enterprise in trying to better himself and to learn more. He would go down to the library, local library, and just read as much as he could. There's a great story. One time he was reading in the library, and the librarian came up to him and said, what are you reading? And he said, none of your business. Oh, I see there's some complaints on the bad time. Let me try it without this extra microphone. Does that sound any better without this microphone? Or is that about the same or worse? Oh, it's the same. I don't know what's causing it then. Usually works all right. I'm not very good at this technical stuff. I hope it improves. But I'm sorry, I can't solve those problems. Yeah, what's different? Well, I guess it is not as good this week. That would be what's different. I don't know. Well, let's hope it improves. We'll see what happens. Okay, so as I say, they tell the librarian, mind your own business. Now, Proudhon also was the first person who called himself an anarchist. The word had been used by people before him, but it was always used as a very negative, pejorative term. It was, oh, this is anarchistical, this is terrible. This is a really terrible thing. You wouldn't want to be called an anarchist, but Proudhon was willing to call himself an anarchist. And he, although he was an anarchist, he supported the French Revolution of 1848. Remember, for those of you just remember your French history, remember, after Napoleon was overthrown by the Dengal and Elba. Louis XVIII became the King of France. Louis XVIII was the brother of Louis XVI, who had been the king who was executed in January 1793. Okay, so Louis XVIII came back, and he ruled until he was then succeeded by his brother, the Comte d'Artois, who was Charles X. Charles X was also the brother of Louis XIV. Louis XVI, I mean, Louis XVIII didn't have any children, so Charles X came to, and he was considered an ultra-reactionary. He was overthrown in 1830 by Louis Philippe, who was from a different branch of the Bourbon family, from the Orleanist branch of Bourbon family. He became the king in a rather more liberal regime. And he lasted until 1848, and then he was overthrown in February 1848. It was replaced by the Republic. But in the election of December 1848, the winner was Louis Napoleon, who was the nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte. There was some doubt whether he was really legitimately the nephew, but he claimed to be. And he became president. Then he declared himself president for life, and then eventually became emperor. A little further away from the microphone. Okay, I'll try it now. Is this any better? Let's hope so. Okay, so Proudhon, although he didn't believe in a political system, he did support the revolution of 1848, but he was in jail for a while under Louis Napoleon. So he was not, didn't do too well. Okay, well, let's try it without then. Okay, now, we've already had a joke about this, but Proudhon is probably best known for a statement that came out in his first book, which is called What is Property? And the statement is, property is theft. Oh, it must have been the other microphone. Okay, well, that's good. So now, can anybody tell me, if you took the statement, property is theft, quite literally, what would be wrong with it? Suppose somebody said, well, property is theft. Of course, libertarians of the Rothbardian kind wouldn't accept this, because we would have a different view of property acquired, we have a different view of property. But what's wrong with the statement, property is theft, just considered by itself? Do we have any suggestions? Again, because the concept of theft depends on legitimate property in the first place. Yes, that's right, because if you steal, you're taking someone else's property. So it can't be that all property is theft, because you couldn't have theft unless you're taking what belongs to somebody. So people said, oh, doesn't this show how ridiculous Proudhon was? So you don't have to worry about it, just making nonsensical remarks. But if you look at what he said, he didn't mean that all property was theft. He just liked to express himself in a paradoxical way. It was his way of getting attention. He was just like, sometimes French writers do that, and express himself in paradox, but he didn't mean to take it strictly speaking, that all property was theft. In fact, he recognized that people are what we would call today self-owners. People have the right to the product of their labor. But he was very much against the capitalist economic system. He didn't approve of interest in capital goods during the return or rent that you got payment for land that you own. Or he didn't approve of also working for an employer who they go to work for someone you're working for McDonald's, so you're just doing certain labor, you're serving the food, but someone else owns the company. He didn't approve of that. He favored an association of workers' cooperatives. So we're not going to be talking about the economic views of the VW, because I don't think there's much to them. He wrote a lot about economics, but it wasn't really where his biggest contribution was. But I just wanted to mention, so you know, that he's not rejecting property altogether. It's just certain kinds of property. And I see Mark Warren, for example, he also said property is liberty. Yes, he said that else later in the book. Now, another misconception about Proudhon is that some people who viewed him as a precursor of fascism, you wouldn't think an anarchist would have much to do in fascism, but there was an influential article by came out in American Historical Review in January 1945. I was during J. Salvin Shapiro, who was a professor in New York, a very influential historian of modern nationalism and fascism. And his article was called Proudhon, Harbinger of Fascism. So how did he get to that view? Well, Proudhon wrote a book on war that's in two parts. In the first part, he starts praising all the features, good features of war. People can have chance in war to show heroic virtue and all sorts of military virtue. So people such as Shapiro think, wow, look, he's glorifying war. He's not somebody saying, look how terrible war is, glorifying war. But in the second part of the book, even though he said you can develop all sorts of virtues in war that you couldn't have in peace, he still rejects war. He says, no, that is not the way to do things. And he rejected violent revolution also. Although he supported, I say, the French Revolution 1848, he urged nonviolence. He was very much against violence. So he doesn't fit in with this model of the idea that Shapiro had of Proudhon as a precursor of fascism. Now, another thing that some people accept, there are some suggestions, although Proudhon didn't write about this many details in his journal. He sometimes seems to have been quite anti-Jewish. He makes remarks about Jewish financiers and such. So some people thought that had an influence on French anti-Semitic writing. Now also, there was a French fascist in the early 20th century, Georges Valois, who was very influenced by Proudhon. So people might think that might be one reason people think he was a fascist, but he's not predominantly responsible for what Valois made of it. And also, Proudhon also influenced the great writer Georges Sorel. But then can anybody tell me what was the most famous book of Georges Sorel? Violence, just reflections on violence. So he's not very highly who done, but some people see Sorel as a fascist, a precursor to fascism and so forth. Anyway, that was why some people knew Proudhon in that way. But now, having given some background of Proudhon, I want to say a little bit about what are the insights we can get for him. So far we said, well, he's wrongly classified as a fascist and he didn't reject all property. You know, he said property is stuff, he didn't reject property, had rather unusual, not very good ideas on economics, not good incentive, not really insightful. So why are we studying what was his contribution to anarchist theory? And I think the fundamental point that he contributes to anarchist theory is a contrast between contract and authority. Basically says, and this is a theme that he develops later by Franz Oppenheimer and Albert Dürer, there are really two ways we can organize any relationship between people. One would be one person is telling the other one what to do. Say somebody's in authority. You have to pay your taxes to the government because the government orders you to do that. If you don't, they're going to come after you. They're going to use force against you. And the other kind of relationship is one of contract, which is you, all the people in an exchange, you have to have two people to contract and two persons. So both of the people want to be in the relationship, so they make an agreement just based on what they want to do. It isn't that one person is forcing the other one to do anything that he or she doesn't want to do. If they mutually agree to do something. So this is contract as opposed to authority, which is somebody saying, you must do this or else. And Proudhon calls justice in the state there where you people are basing the relation on contract, you're just doing things because that's what you want. He calls it commutative justice. He gets his term from Aristotle. Aristotle had classification forms of justice. In this kind, we call commutative justice. I'm going to say he contrasts a society based on contract with one based on government or authority. So in his anarchist society, there wouldn't be a government where the government is saying, here's what the law is, people must obey these laws. All we would have is exchanges between people based on their mutual agreement. Now, one insight, I think very important insight that Proudhon makes a lot of stress is when he's talking about this notion of authority, he raises the question, well, where does this idea of authority come from? Where do we get the idea that society should be organized by having some group of people, the ones who control the state, telling the rest of us what to do? And he says, and here again he's following Aristotle, this idea has been actually quite influential in studies of the history of political authority. He says we get the idea of authority from the family, in family, thinking of what's something called a patriarchal family, where you have in the family there's the father, mother, and children, and other people in the house. The father is definitely in charge, the father is the head the household. In fact, the Greek word despotes, we got the despot from despotes, means the one that is the head of the household. That's where the term comes from. So we're going to say this is where we get the idea of authority, and people take, they see what's happening, what we have in a family where the father is in charge, the father is laying down the laws, or when people think that government has to establish order in society just like the family. So in a state, we're all one big family where the head of the government is kind of the father. This is sometimes the European monarchs, the king or the emperor would be viewed as the father of the country. The Russian Tsar was very often portrayed that way. Incidentally, I didn't put this down on the slide, but one reason sometimes people classify Proudhon as right-wing or fascist is that, although, as we'll see, he's very much challenging the idea of authority based on the family as the principle of society, as we'll see, he's saying what we really should have is a system society based on contract. Society is not like a family where the father is in charge. Although he said it, he didn't want to modify what relations were in the family. He wasn't somebody who said, oh, look, isn't this unfair? The father is in charge and wife really is subordinate to the husband. It's the head of the household. You don't have kind of a feminist movement in the family on a more egalitarian basis. Proudhon was more of a supporter of a very traditional view of the family and relationship between men and women. So he isn't somebody who would, in that he isn't saying, look, authority is such as a bad idea, but he's saying its place is in the family, not in government society. So, the view he was opposing, as I mentioned, is one that says society, in order to exist, we want to avoid a chaotic system. So we have to have a really order in society just like we do in the family, where there's a hierarchy, say the father is on the top. The mother is less important than the father, and the children have to do both that the father and mother. So everybody has his or her place in the family. Some people said that society should be like this. It's called the term for it, I think, nowadays is a society based on affiliation. Everybody has a certain fixed place, usually based on your family. And what Proudhon said is, that idea is wrong. That's one way you can produce order by having a hierarchical system modeled on the family. Because this is the way of government. There are various types of government you can have, but in all of them, there'll be some person or group will have power over others. So what Proudhon says is something might say, well, I don't like the idea of hierarchy, I don't like the idea of submitting to authority, but we have to have this, otherwise we'll just have chaos and we won't have any kind of structure or order in society. It just doesn't make sense. There's some people who say that today. For example, someone has a website, Gene Callahan, they read his book, Economics for Real People. He used to be very sympathetic to authority and anarchism, but now we've moved in a different direction. It's like, well, look, you anarchists, you're all crazy. If you look at all the great political theories, they say we need to have some system of authority. So, thinking about Kugan, Jackson, you said you could have order in a society not produced by governmental authority, but just as a result of free contractual exchanges among people. And he had a very nice way of expressing it, which is in European Revolution, 19th century. He said, liberty, the mother, not the daughter of order. And this was one of Murray Rothbard's favorite quotations. But what this saying is that you don't need to first have a government setting up laws, and only within that framework do people have liberty. So no, you can start off with people freely making agreements among themselves, and you'll get order as a result. And remember, I said he characterized justice under contractual system, what he called commutative joke of justice. And in an authority with government, we have distributed justice. Again, this term is taken from Aristotle. And what he means by distributed justice is the government is deciding who gets what. So the government is saying, here's what your share is, here's what your share is. It isn't that people are just settling questions of justice and questions just of how, who gets what. By agreement among themselves, the government is saying, distributing resources to people. Now, one of the most, in my opinion, one of the most interesting, important contributions Proudhon made to anarchist thought in the history of global thought generally was his criticism of Rousseau, especially Rousseau's great book, Social Contract. And why is this, why is it important to criticize Rousseau? Well, if you study the standard history of political thought, Rousseau is one of the absolutely major figures that people would be covering. He's regarded as one of the great political theorists. So if you can have some criticism of him, you really, some effective criticism of him, you really achieved a great deal. If, say, you were, any of you were to take a college course in history of political thought, non-political thought, you'd probably be spending a lot of time on Rousseau. Well, what is, of course, we're not getting lecture on each other, just to get so we can understand what Proudhon is criticizing. We want to ask, what did Rousseau regard as the basic political problem? What was he trying to do in the social contract? He made all, certainly not his only book on political theory. Well, he said, everybody wants to be free, but we need to act in common for protection and justice. We can't just live on our own. Actually, we so thought that would be the ideal situation where people could basically living by themselves and just having very few associations with other people. But since that was only workable under very primitive conditions, now that we have a whole lot of people, we can't have that. So we all have to act in common, but we all want to be free. So the problem he set himself in the social contract was we have to find a form of agreement where people remain as free as they were before. So you're acting in common with everybody, but you're still free. And Rousseau thought he could come up with a solution to this, so that seems like you can't do it, because if you're in binding agreement with everybody else, then you're not free. So how could you still be as free as you were before if you enter into this agreement with people. And what Rousseau said is the way you keep your freedom, this is a very paradoxical view, is everybody surrenders everything to the collective body of the whole people. We call this the general will. So you're surrendering all your liberties to the general will. Now, how does the general will decide what to do? Well, you know, if you study meaning, you know, the principle of methodological individuals, only individuals who act. So how can there be this kind of collective body that acts? How can the general will act? Well, Rousseau's answer was, well, there's some issue that's in dispute. Each person will decide to do, come up with some opinion on how to handle this issue. If an issue is posed, you'll have to vote either yes or no. So Rousseau wanted each person to decide by himself or herself what to do, having any association with anybody else, would just think is what would be the best thing, what would advance the interest of everybody. Now, some people might be biased in their own behalf, but Rousseau thought all these biases would cancel out. Some people would be biased one way, other people would be biased another way. But the result of all this deliberation would be what's in everybody's interest, what was the general will would be the majority of the people thought this was the best thing to do. So that would express the general will. Now, you might say, well, okay, suppose you have a voting procedure like that. How is it the case that you're free? What if the general will didn't go the way you wanted? You had a vote in deciding general, but what if it didn't go the way you wanted things to go? How could you still say you're free? Well, it's because you're not subordinated to any particular person. It's not that there's one person who's the king or the dictator. You have to do what that person does. It just, you have to obey the verdict of the collective body. But you might say, okay, well, okay, I'm not subordinated to any particular person. It's still not what I want. And what Rousseau said, this is a very strange idea. He said, no, you're wrong. What you really want to do is what the general will says. You might think you want to do something else, but once the general will has come up with its verdict, that's what you want to do also. This is your real self, is what the general will has decided, because that would be what you would want to do if you were rational. It's rational to go along with the general will. You want to be rational, the general will is what you really want to follow. Trudeau wasn't buying any of that. He said, well, this is really a recipe for despotism. It isn't a system where everybody is free as they were before entering the agreement. They just got together for protection and justice. It's really a system of despotism because each person doesn't get to do what he or she wants. In a system of contract, you do only what you agree to. If you don't agree to do something, then you're not bound to do it. It isn't that you have to do something because general will decide that way. It's how you really want to do what the general will says. You, in a system of contract, you only have to do what you agree to. Trudeau makes another significant criticism and says, let's forget about all this at least temporarily. Let's just talk about Rousseau's system as it stands. Let's put aside this basic point that you're not really free if you're following the general will, because you might not want what the general will and decide on. He said, even within the system, the general will isn't really in charge, because what is it that the general will is deciding on? I mentioned there are various disputed questions that the general will is deciding, but each person will deliberate on what to do on this question to come up, and the majority will express general will. But what is up for this deliberation, according to Rousseau, it's only certain general principles of law. And it turns out that day-to-day matters are handled by the government. So even within Rousseau's own system, really the people aren't really deciding on things, even when they come together in the general will. It's really an elite, the ones in the government, who are deciding the day-to-day issues. And in fact, Rousseau wasn't sympathetic to democracy, and his general will is compatible with tyranny as we ordinarily understand it. And you could have, in his system, say, rule by one or a few. You have a general will setting forward certain general principles, certain principles of law, but all the political questions of the day would be decided by who's running the government. And there's a whole tradition since Rousseau, people have written on Rousseau, who see Rousseau as a precursor of totalitarianism, and Proudhon is an important figure in this tradition. Of course, he didn't have the name totalitarianism when he was writing that to me. Only later, I think it came in the Italian fascism, but he has the notion of Rousseau as someone who's an enemy of liberty. There's a very interesting book by the Israeli historian Jacob Talmon, J.L. Talmon, called The Origins of Totalitarian Democracy. It's very good to read on this topic if you're interested. Now, Proudhon also applied his principle of authority to French politics. He said the French Revolution was supposed to be for the people, remember, the third estate is rebelling against the king, the clergy nobility, but individuals were not free to rule themselves. We had an elite that was governing in the name of collectivity. It wasn't one of genuine rule by individuals. And Proudhon is very anti-Robespierre. Again, that's another tradition that sees Robespierre and the Jacobins as enemies of liberty. Proudhon prefers Robespierre's rival, Danton, who was in the Gironde party, is a more idealistic and truly revolutionary thing. He thinks Robespierre was interested in personal power. Now, I haven't left very much time to talk about Bakunin, but one other thing on Proudhon is he uses some arguments about democracy that we'll see later in Lysander Spooner, that if supporters of democracy say that people can send to the government, and the question comes up, when did they do so? Well, Proudhon says he hasn't consented. When is he consented to the government? How is it supposed to be that we consent to the government if they, we could say, you consent to listen to my lecture, all come here, but how did you consent to the government when you never agreed that you're going to go along with the government? You don't have any choice. And he raised another criticism of democracy. He says there are always difficult questions that will confront a democracy. For example, should there be a single plural executive? Should there be one person in charge? Should there be several in charge? He says there can't be a consensus on these, so because there isn't going to be an agreement, democracy would necessarily be ruled by someone or the other, because these questions would have to be decided one way or the other, and then it would be the ones who get their way would be ruling over the others at least on that particular issue. Now, I want to say a little bit, I didn't have as much on Bakunin begun, but Bakunin is a very interesting figure also. He lived from 1814 to 1876. He was from, unlike Kugan, who was just from a poor family, Bakunin was from a noble but poor family. And in his youth, he studied German philosophy, especially Hegel, which he turned against Hegel later on. And at the University of Berlin, he attended lectures by Friedrich Schelling. Schelling was been a somewhat older friend of Hegel, who lived not quite a bit longer than Hegel, and gave famous six series of lectures at the University of Berlin. And in 1841, Bakunin was in the audience for Schelling's lecture. This is in the same audience as Bakunin and Friedrich Engels, the great collaborator of Karl Marx, and also the Danish theologian Søren Kierkegaard. It was a very distinguished group and a very good audience, all the famous figures that were listening to Schelling. Bakunin was involved in the Czech Revolution in 1848. Remember, in Europe in 1848, there were revolutions all over, France and Germany, there were all sorts of revolutions. And Bakunin was involved in the Czech Revolution. But the government of Saxony turned him over to the Russian government and was in prison for several years. And while he was in prison, he wrote a confession of what he'd done in that political activity to Tsar Nicholas I. It was at the order of the Tsar that he wrote this. And the Tsar read his confession, commented on it, and said, well, he hadn't really realized what a mistake he made. Eric Vogelin had a very interesting article on Bakunin's confession. But eventually, Bakunin was released from prison, spending days down in Siberia, and he managed to escape from Siberia. One reason he was able to escape was, I think, the governor of Siberia at the time, where several of the officials there were all relatives of his, remember this guy. Noble family. And when he escaped, he went back to Europe and met both Karl Marx and Proudhon, and he became very interested in Marxist economics. But in fact, he was planning to translate Marx's great European Economics into Russian. But he later quarreled with Marx and was discussing with very shortly, but his criticism of Marxism was he thought that Marx's socialist regime would lead to dictatorship by an elite class of intellectuals. And like Proudhon, believed in an economic system run by syndicates of workers. You have groups of workers getting together and running production. There wouldn't be capitalists or people who own the firm that just had workers who were just deciding what to do. And this would be organized on a federal system. It would be local control of what was produced in certain areas, and then the people within each region would get together with others and they would arrange how to coordinate their various activities. This might be getting Proudhon also. Now, one of the, to get what I think is one of Bakunin's main insights, one of his main contributions to political theory, Anarchist thought, we have to first look at his philosophy a little bit. He was a materialist that they thought there was nothing that exists except matter. People's ideas or minds are just forms that matter takes in, and ideas are just productions of the brain. And he strongly believed that God doesn't exist and God is an illusion. He's a very strong atheist. Now, regardless of whether you, what you think of that, I don't think the way he developed this idea isn't worth that much study. It wasn't very original in what he said. He was just expressing some popular ideas at the time. He just rejected rejected belief in God, just said that all that existed matter. Now someone says Kuntz is not really a philosophical atheist, but more of a God hater. I don't think I'd agree with that. No, I mean, he pretty much had a philosophical view in which there were no spiritual entities. I think it wasn't just that he didn't like God or invented religions and actually didn't believe in God. And I say what he said there isn't that significant. What I thought was his very good insight is that the state will very often use a theological rationale to justify its rule. The rulers will have direct access to God. So this is why you have to obey the state, because the rulers have some form of direct access to God. So since you want to do what God says, you better do what the rulers say as well. And what Bakunin says is that what's taking place in history, he says, well, we start off as animals. Remember, people at the time where Darwin's evolution came out in 1859. The Descent of Man came out later in 1871. But evolutionary ideas were very much in the air. So Bakunin says, well, we start off as animals. And what we try to do, what the aim of history is to try to move from our animal origin to control by reason. And he understands reason in a way that's consistent with materialism. Remember, the materialists say there's nothing that exists except matter. So it isn't that reason, according to Kuhn, is somehow separate entity. It isn't that there's abstract ideas that exist apart from matter. Ideas are just an emanation of the brain. But nevertheless, what we're trying to do in history is get control by reason. Now, there were various philosophies, let's say, like idealist philosophies, such as that of Hegel, Schelling, the one who was lecturing in 10, who, although they differed somewhat from conventional Christianity, they postulated, they had the notion of ideas as independent of matter. Ideas are exist apart from matter, or some sense higher than matter. And Bakunin didn't go along with that at all. He said that idealist philosophy is just another form of religion. And he pointed to a paradox, and he said, those who stress the ideal, those who say, well, matter isn't all that much, it's God or ideas that exist apart from that, because they tend to be very ruthless in practice and their intent on their own interest. But those are materialistic thought tend to allow more scope for reason, whether that's right or wrong for the matter, an interesting conjecture. Now, here, this will be the last topic I'll be talking about. He makes it, he has a very, another very valuable point to make. On one hand, he recognizes the authority of science, that people can alter scientific laws and independent counter in planned reactions. And if you're walking across the street, if you walk in front of a moving car, certain things are going to happen to you based on laws of physics. There's nothing you can do about it. We can't just decide, well, we don't want to obey the laws of science. They're just there regards to whether we want to obey these laws or not. We'd better find out what they are, and that will enable us to achieve what we want in a more expeditious way. And scientists are very valuable because they're the ones who discover the scientific law. But here's where he said, even though the scientists are very important, we have to be very careful about giving control of society to body scientists. Sometimes people say, well, wouldn't it be a good idea to just get the best brain, the best scientists together, and let them control society? And Bakunin said, no, that wouldn't be a good idea, because if you have an entrenched body of scientists, it will tend to become corrupt, and then that will be acting, ruled by scientists, will just be acting in the interests of the scientists themselves. They won't be people just trying to discover scientific laws. We can't trust them. They'll just act in their own interest. And he thought, he applied this point to Marxism. He said that Marx was talking about, Marx said, favored a revolution in which workers, the proletariat, will come to power. Maybe about the dictatorship of the proletariat. But Bakunin said, what will happen if you had a Marxist revolution? You'd have rule by elite intellectuals, a group of intellectuals and government bureaucrats would really be running things. And this proved, at least in many respects, to be the case. And in the 20th century, after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1970, there was a group of theorists who were called theorists of the new class, who argued that communism was really ruled by an elite of Communist Party members and government officials. So these people said, and they were agreeing with Bakunin, that communism is not really a system of workers' control. It's more of a system where you have this elite group of intellectuals in charge. There was one Polish writer, Jan Machajski, who was in the 20s, who was very influenced by Bakunin, viewed Marxism as the class ideology of intellectuals. Remember, Marx was always talking, they could say, various systems of thought. They are not really just aiming at the pursuit of truth. They express certain class interests, for example. British economics, Ricardian economics, 19th century, really expressed the interests of the capitalist class. So Mahajski said, well, Marxism is also an ideology that expresses the interests of the intellectuals, the system where the intellectuals were in control. Okay, so I think I'll stop now and we can go to the question. Let me just see if people have quite a few comments here. I can see if I have to say anything in response there. Okay. So things got better when we signed after I discarded that extra month. Okay. We mentioned that one already. Let me see that. Now, here's one from David Kelly. I wonder how Bakunin would have viewed the idea of Thomas Kuhn regarding the operation of science and science. But he might have been very sympathetic to that, because Kuhn was considering science not just kind of a disembodied system of thought, but real scientists in control now. One different paradigm replaced another. In fact, he'd be very interested. You know, there was a friend of Kuhn, a remote author, someone called Paul Feyerabend, who had a book called Science for the People. And what he claimed, Feyerabend claimed, was that somewhat similar to Bakunin, that there's a danger of kind of a group of scientists in control of science, and he thought it would be desirable just to have people in general developing their own ideas and not subordinate themselves to what the elite group had thought was best. So you have this anti-elitism in between that you do find in certain, in Ireland to some extent, perhaps. I think Kuhn didn't have that same notion, and Kuhn is opening up the area of how personal personalities and groups affect the growth of science. I think that's a very good question. Now, Carl says, giving control to one is just from setting up authority. And you see certain threats and bars in this and so on. Yes, I think that's certainly something the Kuhn and Kuhn would have agreed about. Okay, so that's what I got from the chat. So now we can go crazy. The Kuhn new class is you sure managed to take off a lot of close over to Stalin's and Stalin's. Yeah, so he was one of the leading theorists of the new class. I'd have to check to what extent he was influenced by the Kuhn, and he seems to spend a lot of time talking about what developed in Yugoslavia and also in Russia, but I'm sure he read Bakunin. He was a very well-known figure, kind of, he was one of the leading theorists of the new class. He also was then, I think he was very prominent with the Yugoslav government. I think he was the vice president with them. He quarreled with Tito, Marshal Tito, and I think he was in jail for a while. Yes, that's right. I mean, there were also various American figures like James Burnham, the footman of the Revolution, who developed similar views also. Burnham was one of the founders of the National Review. Now, James and I have read Peter Kropotkin came after Bakunin. Are there ideas similar? Well, Kropotkin had a somewhat different view of things. Kropotkin was very interested in theory of evolution, but he thought Darwin had made a mistake. Darwin was stressing struggle in evolution. Remember that kind of Darwin's thinking that on the origin of species or the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. And Kropotkin said, no, what's important more is cooperation. This is a key principle in evolution thought. This could be applied to society. He was a much more peaceful figure than Bakunin. Bakunin, I didn't discuss this in the lecture, but he was someone who was willing to countenance violence in getting what he wanted. He had one of his disciples called Chaya, one of the important terrorists. Kropotkin was very much not that. And Kropotkin lasted much longer than Bakunin. He was around when they had the Russian Revolution. He lasted a bit longer. Someone pointed out he wasn't loyalty to the title prince in Russia was not a noble, it was not a royal type, the noble type, the highest noble type. It wasn't royalty. He was from a very important noble family. So that's right. I mean, Bakunin was more minor than nobility. Now, Joe Stivaletta says, Sanctimini Valley Bernowski says, the value is Sanctimini. Value signs your identity in the virtue of this number and from the finger writing called the caveat by which every profession reminds itself and build and grown out of practice of some of the inescapable conditions of practice. That's an interesting view. I mean, it's I don't know that Bakunin would be committed to either accepting or rejecting that. And that can be said, well, sign, it's more of a materialist view. You have to take what's important, not the ideas that signs have, how signs is important, but their actual practices. That may be so, but as I say, I don't think Bakunin would be committed one way or the other. Darian says, how to prove out the rash lines of distance in order that people own the property or labor, and the idea that they're legitimate to hire yourself out, and the word you can't sell your labor, and what way do you really own it? I don't know that he did. See, but I think what he might say is, would you say if you can't sell yourself into slavery, you don't really own yourself? Walter Bach would say that. He wouldn't. So he said, well, you own your labor, but really, you'd be enslaving yourself to somebody else if you sold your labor to others. You should, it's really, I don't know if he said you should be forbidden to do it, it wouldn't be a good thing to do. It would be something you do only in a system that is controlled by people who weren't actually in your interest in the function of this. And of course, I don't think we cannot use light on the economics, but that was the way it looked at it. So just on this, why shouldn't I sell my labor? Just thought it's pretty obvious that would be a bad thing to do, just like selling yourself in slavery. So, Phil says, how do these things workers groups would be organized those who say, well, he just thought they didn't really develop in the Norman's teacher, or they just thought they would have local groups agreeing on what to do, and then you gradually have larger and larger groups agreeing, you would have a series of agreements from the bottom up and so forth. That creates that the Russian has a computer over the Grand Duke sounds like nobility, it's royalty. But I recommend a trip to the Army Museum in Kremlin. Oh, well, I've never been there, but you're quite right on Grand Duke. I mean, similar to Archduke in the Austrian Empire, Archduke is Emperor Taiwan. Grand Duke is Highness of the Prince. And you find, say, in the Prussian system, say, when you had Prince Bismarck, when he was created as the Duke of Lauenburg by the Emperor, that was a promotion, so Duke would be was a promotion. Prince was a very high title. I say Russian was not the highest non-royal title. But you find princes like, say, the House of Grimaldi, which is the ruling family in Monaco, that prince is not a royal prince. The prince is a sovereign prince, but not a royal prince. Whoever is, used to be Prince Ranier back in the old days. He's not around anymore. The Prince of Monaco would have a title, His Serene Highness, not His Royal Highness. Crazy the last 2 years, the monarch was a grand duke of Bohemia, who's advised to follow the US as one of his which he shortly thereafter. The Romanovs were still very active family. They're still supporting the Romanov today. And Joseph didn't decide to sign the ordinance without force or state in the past. Well, I think that's certainly right, but the point wasn't saying that scientists couldn't organize without force or state. Like, he was objecting to the notion that scientists should be put in charge just on the ground that they were the ones who were pursuing truth. He said, if you do that, then they'll just start acting in their own interest and become corrupt. But he wasn't saying that in order to have a scientific organization, you have to be forced. I don't think he would have said, no, you can't have scientific organizations or societies without force. Okay, so then in the 19th century, Panthers were taken over the Hanseatic League and the London Contemporary Rough Party. I'm not recalling that it did, but I can't say they didn't. There was an interesting book on the Hanseatic League by Ian Colvin. He had two books, giving on the influence of the British support for the Hanseatic League, that was very influential in British foreign policy. So just the Hanseatic League makes it change my mind. I don't think Hanseatic League played much of a role in 19th century Anarchist things, but I wouldn't put too much credence in what I'm saying, what we call it that came up. I'd have to check into that. Well, I hope, last week around this time, this 92-year-old neighbor of mine decided to start playing the piano very loudly. I hope he doesn't have a repeat concert this time. Oh, good. He was thinking why. That Amastri says, in the reading for God, says that the golden rule and contract should be based on social order. This seems very sympathetic to a free market view. Now, to be elaborating positions of the writer, what do you think of classical economics? And Smith, for example, his biggest book on economics was called Philosophy of Poverty or System of Economic Contradiction. And what he thought was, where you differ with and standard free market is he thought that capitalists, or people who own firms and lend money with interest, really wouldn't come about through free agreement. He viewed them exploiters, even that way, similar to Marx, the capitalists earn rate of return through exploitation of the workers. So he was, in that sense, quite critical of classical economics. And he had debates on economic theory, especially on the interest, with the great free market economist, Friedrich Bastiat. They had an exchange of language, each with attacking each other. Interesting. And Proudhon was aware of free market people and didn't accept them. Okay. Now, Joe said the scientist allows him to work too closely with the policy to destroy the integrity of science. So I think that was something Bakunin was stressing very much. Now, Marx is, why did Marx dislike the philosophy of poverty? Well, he thought that he said that Proudhon really doesn't understand economics. He was just engaging in kind of just idle dialect. Which, remember when I was talking about Proudhon saying property is theft, I said it wasn't something he meant to be taken really in, taken just as you would read it, that all property is theft, because then it would be the contradiction to say, but Proudhon liked to write in paradoxes, and Marx thought they really didn't amount to anything. They were just kind of, you didn't understand. There was a personal rivalry between them. First, they'd gotten along, and Marx praised Proudhon, and Proudhon started studying Marx, but then they quarreled about particular people. There was one writer, German writer, Karl Grün, G-R-U-M, and that Marx really hated, and Proudhon defended him. So Marx is someone who took personal disputes very seriously and didn't like Proudhon after that at all. So I think as I tried to mention in the lecture, Proudhon's views on economics aren't really valuable. Although he has somewhat of a, he has somewhat of a following to an extent among contemporary left libertarians, like Kevin Carson is very influenced by Proudhon. He adopts the name mutualism. That's something you get. I don't think very much of those people, but there are people who like them. I don't see much of them myself. And so Proudhon England happens with the ever mutual knowledge. I don't think so, no. Now remember Proudhon died in 1865. I mean Spooner was around before then, but he was writing on slavery. So I don't think predominantly somewhat earlier figure. Remember, Tucker lasted quite a bit longer. And he was around after World War I. Now, Ganja was predominantly the first concept of prior anarchism himself. And Crace, well, I, you know, they're really the four predominant, the precursors of anarchism really didn't call themselves, and you have, they really weren't that, precursors of anarchism. You could go back, say, Chinese thought, and say something that the Chinese thought isn't that anarchist idea, but you don't really find that much systematically before. Now, his fault was on by 1965. Well, maybe if we accept backwards causation, it's logically possible that it is his fault. You never know. And now, there is so who wants us to think the time frame. That's right, time frame. You could have backwards causation without time travel, also have time travel without causation. You wouldn't have to imagine the guilt, just that there's a logically possible world in which you're guilty and pre-dawn. That's why you don't have to feel guilty now. Is that going to be any clearer? Not in one possible world, in the actual world. I don't know. I wouldn't presume to say that other possible. Is it going to be on a team shirt? only if we're playing golf. Look what happened. It proved wrong when he didn't. Oh, you like, yes. Spooner would certainly be there. In the remaining lecture, of course, we'll be covering people who are much ones who are in the standard libertarian field of vision. So we won't be dealing with these people who may not have, like Stoner or Proudhon, who may not have encountered that much of them if you were standard libertarian, would be dealing much more in the libertarian people. People you'll probably be familiar with already. Again, they never heard of standard improvement before this course. It's interesting. They're not. I don't think libertarians would tend to study them very much. No treason essays were they ever written. I'll be checking into that when I get my lecture on Spooner together. Marx's tradition of libertarian and socialist. Yes, there were certainly socialists who call themselves libertarian. In fact, even today, Noam Chomsky, who considers himself an anarchist of some sort, has in mind some kind of socialist system, that he's very strongly opposed to Rothbard's system. Now, Bakunin was a very well-known figure. Now, Joseph, he lived in my hometown, Chomsky does. Have you ever seen him? Oh, you say, Galbraith, oh, yes. Yes, he was, I remember hearing him lecture one very, very tall man, Galbraith. I see some of you, a lot of you took quiz number one and people are doing well on it. Now, Crater did, Proudhon and Bakunin acknowledge each other. Well, they met when Bakunin was in France. I don't think Proudhon ever refers to Bakunin, but Bakunin may refer to Proudhon. I don't know that for sure, but I think Bakunin was certainly more aware of Proudhon than the other way around. Bakunin was known as an early revolutionary, but I think his writings were somewhat afterward. Craig, which one do you think is the bigger name? Oh, I see. Oh, you know, I should mention a very interesting book on Proudhon by Cardinal de Lubach. You wouldn't expect a Catholic, right? You wouldn't expect him to be writing on Proudhon, but Proudhon is very critical of religion. But Cardinal de Lubach has a very interesting book on him. Now, Craig said, "Users are free and easy to come out. Could you consider bringing Murray Rothbard to the screener lecture?" I don't think we could manage it in the actual world. Whether it's logically possible is another question altogether. Short notice, no, I'd say more lack of causal power. Okay, well, thanks everybody. I see we're about out of time now, so thanks very much, and I hope we'll be seeing you next week. We'll be talking about Molinari. Okay. Thanks a lot, everybody. Bye. See you next week.